When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, so the test, first off, is all multiple choice. There is no short answer. There is no FRQs. There's no nothing like that. So that you can take that off your worry list. There's no, you don't have to graph or anything like that. The only thing I would say is that there are some unit one and two stuff that's on there, but it's the specific stuff in the review. And so as we go over it, hopefully it'll jog your memory and bring it back. I really want to kind of change the format, the pacing of the class. I feel like we spent way too much time on one and two when we should have spent more time on the stuff we did this semester. And anyways, that's just me kind of thinking out loud. Let's get going. So as I do this review, I always struggle, especially with a macro class, like how do I give enough information about the test question for them to do really well and then not give away like answers and things like that. And just, it's a struggle. So I'm going to talk about the topics, and each topic that I talk about is on the test. If you see a topic on the study guide, I promise you that topic is on the test. So the first thing we're going to talk about is the propensity to save and consume. You're guaranteed that there will be a question on that stuff. So I'm not trying to waste people's time with studying for stuff that you don't have to know or be concerned about for the test. Alrighty. And so I'm going to talk in kind of overview terms when I talk about this stuff, trying to make sure that I'm not giving away too much, if that makes sense. If it makes sense in my head, it might not make sense in yours. All right. So first up is multiple propensity to save and consume. And this is a topic from 3.2. If you need to go back and reference anything from there, remember, first off, there's only two things that we can do with our money. We can spend it or we can save it. And when we take a look at this, it is basically taking a look at the relationship between the changes in our income, you know, what we spend and save and all that kind of stuff, versus the changes in savings and consumption. So, hey, here's the money I'm making. And then how much of that money am I going to spend on these products over here? How much of that money am I going to consume over there? All right. MPS is a fraction of additional income that we would rather save than spend. And the marginal propensity to consume is the fraction of additional income that we would rather spend than save. Excuse me. And so basically this is going to affect, when we take a look at this, it affects our saving and consumption behavior. So yeah, there's not many people out there as individuals that are going to, well, hey, let me sit down and, you know, math out my marginal propensity to consume because I got this extra $10 at work today. Most people aren't going to do that kind of stuff. But economists will take a look at this and look at trends and see, okay, people are making this much more money this quarter as a whole in America or wherever we're talking about, and they're out there consuming this much versus they're saving this much. And it can give them an idea of some of our spending trends and what we're doing with our money, what's going on with the banks, how much of the loanable funds are out there and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, for us, just on its head, the marginal propensity to save and consume is well, why would we do that? But it gives the economists a lot of trends and data and things like that. All right, I can't spend that much time on every single topic or we're never gonna get done. So I'm gonna try and move a little bit quicker. All right. The next one is 3.6 and 7, the long run effects on aggregate demand, real GDP, and price level. Excuse me. So remember, the long run, we compare this sometimes to that Phillips curve because it's the production, basically. And that's a very, 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 very light. That's probably not the right word, but very broad way to say about the long run. But remember, in the long run, your businesses will adapt. And that's the big key difference between the long run and the short run, is that in the long run, all the things that are being happened, that are being thrown at businesses, corporations, and all that kind of stuff, that they can adapt and they can change and make adjustments. And that's why it's that straight line. That's what I was trying to get at, but I failed miserably. So that's why it's that straight up and down line for the long run. So in the long run, changes in agri demand will affect the level of real gross domestic product and the price level. An increase in agri demand leads to higher real GDP. Remember, GDP is gross domestic product, and that higher price level, while the decrease can lead to lower GDP and lower price levels. So basically for this question, you're having to figure out what's it asking me, what's it asking me to take a look at. Is it a increase in demand? Is it a decrease in demand? Because the question is going to be about changes in agri demand, basically, and how it affects these other pieces. All right. So overall, remember, once again, that in the long run, everything's going to adjust and go back to kind of that middle long run equilibrium. 3.6 and 7, the graph analysis, you will have to look at a graph. It will probably be an agri demand or an agri supply thing. So just remember some of the things that play into that. It's the same rules from back in the first semester with demand and supply, where shifts means that the price has stayed the same of a product, but the demand has changed or the supply has changed versus movement on the curve. Agri demand and agri supply equilibrium, that is just where they meet in the model. So on our graph, agri demand and agri supply meet in the middle, and that is where quantity of GDP equals the quantity supplied of real GDP and the quantity demand of real GDP are at the same point. Okay. 3.9, automatic stabilizers. So remember, stabilizers are policies that the government comes up with to try and keep our economy going. When there might be issues, when there are fluctuations, whether they be positive or negative. Automatic are ones that just automatically kick in. A great example of an automatic stabilizer is unemployment. If you ever lose your job, there's a good chance that you'll have the ability to go and collect unemployment. You don't have to do anything special. I mean, you have to fill out the paperwork and whatnot and follow the rules that go with unemployment, but you can just go do it. There's not going to be a government bill, law that has to get passed or policy that's created. You just go and you start working on collecting unemployment. That's to try and keep the economy as stable as possible. That's why they're called automatic stabilizers. Because the idea is when we lose our job, we don't have any money coming in. And we don't have money coming in, we're not out there spending money on products. And when we're not spending money on products, if enough people aren't spending money on products, then more people are going to lose their job. And then more people can't buy stuff. And less stuff needs to be produced, and it's this endless cycle. So the unemployment is to give you, it's not a way to make money and get rich, obviously, but it keeps you going. It keeps you spending money in the economy. All righty. 3.8, fiscal policy. This is just what the government does. And when I say government, remember, this is specifically the president and Congress that will do this. And for us, we really focus in on taxing and spending. I do, just as a gov teacher in my face-to-face job, the tax thing is just not really that big of an option because it takes forever for them to do anything with tax policy. So it's not something that's going to happen super quick. So typically it's going to be spending. And remember, when the government's trying to fight unemployment, they're trying to increase our demand. They're going to throw money at it by spending, spending, spending. And then when they are going to try to fight inflation, they're going to pull money out by cutting their spending. The tax side, they would raise taxes to try and fight inflation, and they would decrease taxes to try and fight unemployment. Now, don't confuse. Well, we'll get into monetary policy later. You've got expansionary fiscal policy and contractionary fiscal policy. Expansionary is when they're throwing money at it. So they're spending, spending, spending. They're fighting unemployment. Contractionary is when they're pulling money out because they're fighting inflation. 3.3, shifts of the short-run agri supply curve. So the short-run agri supply curve, remember, is looking at that short run versus the long run. Remember, we said the long run in that time, businesses, corporations, suppliers basically can adjust to whatever's going on. In the short run, those factors are not. They're not able to adjust. So if wages goes way up or wages goes down or whatever might happen to our wages, the business can't adjust to it. Raw materials. Think about all the inputs that goes into making a product. they can't adjust in the short run to the changes in those products. And so it's going to affect their productivity. It's going to affect the price level. It's going to affect the production levels in the short run. All righty. And so this is about the shifts. So positive shifts to the short run lead to increased output and lower prices, while negative shifts are going to lead to decreased output and higher prices. So we got to think about, well, what's happening to the wages, what's happening to the inputs, and is that a positive going to lead to a positive shift in the short run aggregate supply, or is that going to be a decrease and that's going to be a negative? So that's kind of where you're getting with that. 3.6, decrease in business taxes effects on national income, AD and AS. A very long question or very long topic here. Just remember that a decrease in business taxes can lead to an increase in national income by stimulating investment. So if taxes goes down, typically whenever you see taxes goes down, whether it's for us as individuals, whether it's for the businesses or whoever it might be, that's going to be a stimulating thing, because when they lower taxes, for us as individuals, we can go out there and spend more. For businesses and corporations, when they lower taxes, it allows them to produce more, and so they can throw more out there. Alrighty. And then that's going to boost agri demand. So it's kind of all tied together there. When agri demand goes up, real GDP is going to increase. We're going to get lower unemployment in the short run. And this is why you hear so many people talk about, well, we need to reduce the business taxes, versus other people who are saying that we need to increase business taxes. And that'll typically be the fight between the two, is about, well, what's going to happen in the short run and the long run and all that kind of stuff. And just in theory, businesses, when you give them some savings, good things are supposed to happen for the economy. 3.1, agri demand shifts. I'm not going to spend too much time here. It's all the same kind of shifts that happened in demand back in unit one, just on the bigger scale. Okay. So let's just use our income. If our income goes up, agri demand is going to increase. And just be sure you know the shifts. Hey, a right shift is going to be an increase. A left shift is going to be a decrease in our demand. 3.8, fiscal policy, taxes, and spending effects on inflation and unemployment. So we've already kind of talked about fiscal policy and how it's the taxes and the government spending. Okay. So the effect on inflation and employment, once again, because I think I said this earlier, the government is really concerned about two things. They're concerned about unemployment and they're concerned about inflation. Those are the two things they fight, and they will do that through their fiscal policy. And we're just going to focus on spending, because once again, taxes typically doesn't really happen in real time. The government is going to spend to fight unemployment. They're going to cut spending to fight inflation. If you see taxes on there, you're going to want to know that they will increase taxes to fight inflation, and they'll decrease taxes to fight unemployment. But that is what they do. That is their go-to on how they fight those two things. And that's typically the thing. And I'll say one more thing about the government. They would prefer to fight unemployment, because unemployment is easier and it makes them happier, because they get to throw money at the problem. The government officials, they like to spend money because that makes us happy, versus inflation, where they got to cut and they got to take money out of our pocket typically. We don't like that as voters, and so we tend to vote people. All right, 3.3 and 6, change in inputs effects in the short run. So think about the things that affected supply back in unit one. So inputs, so wages, the cost of raw materials, things like that. All those things are going to affect and, you know, possibly shift the short run here. All right, so that's all this is getting at. Excuse me, is those inputs. So if a business raises minimum wage from $15 to $25, you know, what's going to be the effect in the short run? And that's going to decrease their bottom line. So that's probably going to decrease supply. So that's what we're getting at there. 3.3, the reasons for the short run aggregate supply to shift. So they can shift because of input prices. That's that thing we've been talking about, productivity, technology, government regulations, all those things that could possibly cause the short run aggregate supply curve to shift. And remember, a shift to the right is an increase, a shift to the left is a decrease. And then finally for 3.7, long run and economic growth. In the long run, economic growth is driven by increase in the quantity and quality of factors of production. Think of labor, capital, technology, those things. That investing in like us as workers, that's going to lead to long run economic growth. Investing in new tools, better technology, that's going to lead to long run economic growth. That's what we're talking about there. All right. So we're 17 minutes and I feel like I got to really speed up. all right. 4.4, the reserve requirement, excess reserves and cash deposits effects on the money supply. So remember the reserve requirements, that is what the government has for, or the Federal Reserve is going to force banks to keep in reserve when you put money in. So you put $100 in from your graduation present, the bank has to keep a certain amount back. That is going to translate to the money supply because banks loan money out, and the more money they have to keep back, the less they have to loan out. The more money they can send out, then the more money they get to loan out. All right. So that's all that's getting at when we're talking about the reserve requirement and the money supply. When banks receive the cash deposits, it is going to basically create those excess reserves. The money they have that they hold, that's what we're talking about. So they keep that money back. And that's just that. That's the excess reserve that we're talking about. 4.6, Federal Reserve actions when agri demand is growing faster than long run agri supply. So when agri demand is growing faster than the long run agri supply, it leads to inflationary pressure. Remember that we had the inflationary gap, we had the recessionary gap and all that stuff. The Federal Reserve is going to contract. So that's where they're going to increase reserve requirement. They're going to increase the discount rate, and they're going to sell bonds because they want to take money out of the economy when that is happening. 4.1 and 5, the economy in equilibrium. So when agri demand changes, equilibrium happens when agri demand equals agri supply. When the question is about when agri demand changes. So when we see that shift from agri demand one off of equilibrium, how do we get back to what's the new equilibrium? That's what it's going to be talking about. So, if agri demand increases, it leads to higher output and prices in the short run. Well, if it decreases, it leads to lower output and prices. And you're going to have to be able to read this. Okay. And so, that's why I really hope you'll take a piece of paper so you can really graph these things out when they pop up on the test. Because to me, it really helps to visualize instead of trying to do it in your mind. Well, this is happening, but if I can read the graph on my piece of paper, I can really tell kind of what's happening. But the economy will adjust over time to these changes, and agri demand will kind of adjust as well until it reaches the new equilibrium point. 4.6, monetary policy effects on agri demand and agri supply. So monetary policy is what the Fed does. They do the buying and selling of bonds. That's open market operations. They do the discount rate and they do the reserve requirement. Alrighty. The monetary policy effects on agri demand. So when they're putting money into the economy, so they're buying bonds, they're reducing the reserve requirement, that's increasing demand. And that's going to put the opposite pressure on the supply. So basically you got expansionary versus contractionary. Expansionary monetary policies where they throw money at the problem. Contractionary is where they're pulling money out. You have to be able to figure out the effects on agri demand and agri supply when they're doing those things. 4.7, the business outlooks and effects on the loanable funds in the short run. So remember, loanable funds is that money that we have available to us to borrow. Business outlooks, expectations about future economic conditions, investment, all those things are going to influence the demand for loanable funds in the short run. When businesses have a positive outlook, they are going to look to increase. So that's going to increase the demand for loanable funds. And then when things look poorly, recession's coming, that's going to decrease the investment in borrowing. So that's going to decrease the demand for the loanable funds. So that's all that's getting at. Don't get tripped up. Don't get freaked out because you see loanable funds. It's just the money that's available to be borrowed. And it's just typically going to be based on the interest rates. And for this question, it's going to talk about the businesses. 4.6, open market operations for inflation and unemployment. So open market operations, remember that's the buying and selling of bonds. And with inflation, the government, the Federal Reserve is going to sell, try and take money out of our pockets. And then to fight unemployment, they're going to throw money at it by buying bonds. Nominal versus real interest rates and effects of inflation. So nominal interest rates, that's the interest rate on a loan or investment, while real interest rates adjust for inflation by subtracting the inflation rate from the nominal interest rate. And so you have to be able to compare those things. Remember, at the end of the day, all right, interest rates are what drives business investment. Interest rates are what's going to drive our investment, for to be honest with you. When businesses see interest rates that are high, that discourages them from investing, that it discourages them from expanding and those sorts of things. For us, when we see high interest rates on a investment vehicle, we want to put our money into that, and vice versa. When we see low, we want to not put our money into that. 4.6, central bank increasing the money supply, the ways. So open market, they buy bonds. The reserve requirement, they decrease that thing. And the discount rate, they decrease that. 4.5, increases to nominal interest rates. So increases in nominal interest rates occur when the cost of borrowing money or the return on investment increases. Higher nominal interest rates may result from factors like monetary policy changing, so the Federal Reserve and their things, if inflation is having more pressure on us, and things like that. 4.7, reasons for increase in demand for loanable funds. So we've already talked about the loanable funds, so I won't spend too much time here, but remember, that is businesses, that is us, that is whoever wanting to borrow money for whatever reason, okay? And you might see businesses invest because they're excited about the future. You might see them invest because they had a good, really good quarter or whatever it might be. You might see people invest because they're looking to invest in themselves, education, and things like that. And I'm wondering if I'm going to have enough time to finish this whole thing. 4.7, the effects of lower interest rates in a nation. Lower interest rates can stimulate borrowing and investment in a nation by reducing the cost of borrowing money for households, firms, and governments. So we want lower interest rates. And lower interest rates, you need to remember, at the end of the day, are going to encourage us and businesses to borrow. 4.7, shifts to the investment demand curve. The investment demand curve represents the relationship between the real interest rate and the level of investment spending in the economy. Shifts are going to be as the result of the investment demand, because if interest rates are up, we demand more investment, we demand more loanable funds. If interest rates are I might have just confused myself, but if interest rates are up, we demand less. If interest rates are down, we demand more, because once again, we want to borrow at low interest rates. 4.3, the M1 and M2 definitions of money. M1 is most of the liquid forms of money, so the things you can get quickly with currency, such as currency, things like that. M2 is all of M1 plus the assets like savings deposits and money market deposits and things like that. All right. Moving on to 5. And got about 20 minutes left. So I'm trying to move quick. 5.2, the Phillips curve. The Phillips curve is that relationship between unemployment and inflation in an economy and how they affect each other. Okay. When unemployment is low, inflation tends to be high and vice versa. So that's all this is getting at, the Phillips curve. So if you see this question, just know, well, if I see the Phillips curve and it's reading that unemployment's up, then that probably means that it's affecting inflation this way, because you have to fight unemployment by throwing money at it, which creates inflation, and vice versa. 5.4, country's national debt. The national debt, that's all the money that a government owes to its creditors. I think I told y'all our national debt is a very scary number to me. 5.6, what increases long-run growth of an economy? Real per capita income. So a very long topic there. But think of technological innovations, increases in productivity, investment in physical and human capital. So us getting whatever it might be, all those kinds of things are going to increase long-run growth rate. Alrighty. 5.1, expansionary fiscal policy. So we've already talked about this, so I'm not going to talk again here, but that is the government spending. And when they're expanding, they are spending. 5.4, fiscal budget deficit and the government debt. A fiscal budget deficit occurs when the government expenditures exceed revenues. So basically, a budget deficit, that's when the government spends more than they are bringing in. Okay, and our government is really good about that today. That is how they operate. There's no way around it. The interest we owe on our debt is approaching $1 trillion per year. Okay, so just to maintain our debt, we have to pay $1 trillion. So that tells me there's no way that we don't operate without a budget deficit. All right, but the more deficit spending you do, the more debt you're going to go into. So it feels like it's an endless cycle right now because we're not climbing out of this thing. 5.7, business tax cuts and how they shift the short-run aggregate supply. So business taxes can lead to an increase in the short-run aggregate supply because that reduces the amount of money that suppliers have to pay to make a product, and therefore they can produce more. So that's why you hear so many people talk about, when I say so many people, typically it'll be conservatives talking about let's give tax cuts to the businesses because it does, in theory, stimulate the economy. 5.3, velocity of money. The velocity of money measures the rate at which money changes hands or circulates in the economy over a specific period. So for this, remember, we took a look at it and it's basically, all right, here's $10 for graduation. You go out there and spend it and you've just contributed to the velocity of money because now that $10 is going to go somewhere else. It's going to go to someone else's hands and then somebody else's hands and somebody else's hands. So we just measure basically how fast and how the money being spent circulates around the economy. That's all the velocity of money is. A high money, high velocity means that it's going around the economy quickly. So that's typically good. A low velocity means that money is being held onto, is being saved, and that might be that there's less economic activity. 5.6, cause of an increase in real output in the long run. So an increase in the real output in the long run is driven by things like technological progress. So think of all the different computers, think about all the different like robots and things like that that are out there. They're supposed to be increasing productivity. And that's all that's getting at. All right. Because remember, in the long run, businesses will adapt and they're able to, you know, get in. They're able to make changes and adjustments over time. 5.1, the combined effect of expansionary fiscal and monetary policy. So when expansionary fiscal and monetary policies are implemented simultaneously, they work together to stimulate aggregate demand. And I got 10 minutes left. Expansionary fiscal policy involves increased government spending or tax cuts to boost consumption and investment. Basically, if you're seeing the government spending and you're seeing expansionary monetary policy, so the Fed is throwing money at the problem, you are seeing all kinds of money flying in there. And we're typically going to see an increase in inflation when that kind of stuff happens. All right. So yes, you might be fighting unemployment. You might be fighting this problem, but it's going to lead to problems on its own because you expand too much and you're going to create inflation. All right. Hold on 1 second. All right. 6. And just note, if I get cut off because the Zoom time runs out, I will finish up on the podcast and I'll post that as soon as this is done. So my time is limited on the Zoom. I thought I could get this done in the time. So if this recording cuts out, just know that I'm finishing up on the podcast. All right, 6 of the stuff we just covered, 6.4, changes in the market for dollars. That's the shift in the supply and demand for the U.S. dollars in the foreign exchange market. Remember, it's really about appreciation versus depreciation when we're demanding the dollar. So who's buying what product is going to affect the value of our dollar. So people coming in and buying our product versus us going over and buying other people's product is going to affect the dollar market. 6.4, appreciation and depreciation. Appreciation is the increase in value of currency. Depreciation is when it decreases in value. When our money is appreciated, people don't want to buy from us because our money is worth more. They want to buy from us when we have depreciated. 6.5, appreciation of the U.S. dollar, most likely to benefit whom? So that will benefit consumers and businesses in the U.S. who import goods and services from other countries. A stronger dollar makes imports cheaper for U.S. consumers and businesses. So the prices in theory should be lower. 6.6, real interest rates in the U.S. fall relative to real interest rates in Great Britain. That's the specific question that's on there, and we've gone over that. Remember, that's investment. So when real interest rates in the U.S. fall, it leads to a decrease in the attractiveness of U.S. assets compared to British assets. So investors are going to look for those higher returns in Great Britain. So the money is going to go to Great Britain. Let's see, 6.1, CA transactions. So that stands for current account transactions. And that's the international transactions involving trade and goods and things like that. And remember, for our current account, we want to basically be exporting more than we're bringing in. 6.2, exchange rates and the formula. So you need to know this for the test. Exchange rates represent the price of one currency in terms of another. The formula for calculating these things, U.S., you're looking at the dollar per unit of foreign currency. Exchange rate is the domestic currency over the unit of a foreign currency, and then vice versa. And I'm moving quickly, so hopefully I said that correctly. 6.4 and 6, cause of increase in the U.S. dollar relative to the Japanese yen. This is a very specific question. So an increase in the U.S. dollar relative to the yen can be caused by a couple of different things. Higher interest rates in the U.S., stronger economic growth prospects in the U.S., geopolitical things, central bank interventions, any number of things can cause the U.S. dollar to rise compared to the yen. 6.1, cause of increased surplus in the balance of trade. An increased surplus in the balance of trade occurs when a country exports more goods and services than it imports. So that's going back to that current account thing. So if there's an increased surplus in the balance of trade, so that means there's more goods that we have. Basically, we want to be sending out more. We want to export more than we import. And so that's what we're looking for. And when you see that surplus, all that means is that we have a surplus of probably our goods that are here. 6.2, the last thing for 6. Changes in exchange rates. So changes in exchange rates occur basically because of the trade. It's not going to be necessarily driven by me or you going out and going on vacation, although that can contribute. The big thing is going to be the businesses trading, because people want the goods that they want to buy goods. They want goods bought in their currency. They don't want it bought in the other currency. All right, so that is the stuff from this semester. All right, I have about 5 minutes left in the Zoom, so I'm going to just start with one. Just remember, if it stops randomly, then I am going to finish up with the podcast, which will be posted later on. And, you know, 1 and 2 might be the most important stuff, because that's the stuff from last semester. And it just might be the stuff that you need to be filled in most with. All right. Unit 1, absolute and comparative advantage. From an absolute advantage, this is where two countries are producing the same product with the same resources. And if I have the absolute advantage, then I can make those products better and more than you. But that's not fair to me. So we want to specialize in trade. That's where comparative advantage comes from. Remember, comparative advantage is figuring out the opportunity cost of who should give up what and who should specialize in what. And that's all that is getting at. 1.2, the production possibilities curve. Remember, this is the different combinations of two goods that a country or economy can produce given its resources and technology. And remember, it deals with the trade-offs and opportunity costs. So if we're making 100 units of this product and we're here and we're making 0 of this, but we want to make some of the zeros, then we got to give up the opportunity cost of making some of the other, we got to give up some of the things we're making 100 of. And whatever we, so going from 100 to 80 to make 20 units of the other good, that's the opportunity cost. So we give up 20 of good A to make some of good B. Remember, the point out is unattainable, and the point in is where it's bad. Things, we're not using our resources wisely or like we should. Let's see, 1.3, just did comparative advantage. It's going, and PPC, it's going to compare two production possibilities curves. So we already did both of those. The shifters of supply curve, remember, increase, decrease in inputs, price of inputs, more workers, more suppliers, all those things can lead to a increase or decrease in supply. And just remember that the shift, if you see to the right, it's an increase. If you see to the left, it's a decrease. Changes in market equilibrium. Market equilibrium occurs when the quantity demanded equals the quantity supplied at a particular price level. Just equilibrium will shift based on the changes to supply and the changes to demand. The factors of production, that is the land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. Land is any gift of nature. Labor is us. Capital is the tools used to make other products. 1.4, the demand shifters. The big ones are income and our tastes. Those are the big ones that will affect our demand. As we have more income, we buy more. As we have less income, we buy less. And that affects demand and shifts the demand curve. To the right is an increase. To the left is a decrease. Movement versus shift. Movement is when we just see the price changing. Okay, so price went from $1 to $50.50. How that affect demand? And we just show it sliding on our demand curve. Versus a shift, that's where there is no price change. The price stays the same, and we have to show it with a whole new curve. Okay, because the price, something else has affected the product. Okay, I've got unit two to do. And I got a minute left on the Zoom. So I'm going to stop here on the Zoom, and I'm just going to continue on with the podcast, which I'll post in just a few minutes when I'm done with this. So if you made it this far, best of luck on this final exam, best of luck on all your other final exams. And I will say more at the end of the podcast. All right, guys, take care and bye-bye. Brandon, I'm going to stop recording. Take care.
Recording stopped.
Hope the rest of it goes well. See ya.
All right. So sorry, I ran out of time on the Zoom. So I'm picking up here. I'm going to finish up on the podcast. So circular flow. First off, all circular flows are different, but they're all going to have the same thing. You're going to have a household. You're going to have a firm. So household on one side, firm on the other, and then you've got the product market and the factor market. All righty. And it just shows the flow of money, and it shows the flow of products, whether it be the resources that we provide as the household, or it's showing the resources, the product that the firms are producing. Okay. So on the outside is the money. So when you see it and you see the arrows going whichever way they're going, you're going to see the firm paying the business, the firm, in the product market, because that's where we're buying the product that the firm is making. So if I'm going and I'm buying an iPhone, then, you know, that's me, the household, buying a product. The money is going to be out there and it's going to go towards the firm because I'm paying the firm. On the inside of that product market, you're going to see the firm providing the iPhone. Okay. And so you'll see the arrows going from house, from firm to household there. So they're going to be different because we buy and then they provide a product. Now on the bottom side, you'll see the firms paying the households, and the households are providing resources, whether it's our labor, whether it's our land, whatever it might be, that's all that is. So on the outside, you see the money, you see the household paying the firm for their products, and you see the firm paying the households for their products. The factors. And then vice versa, you see the households providing resources to the labor, to the firms, and then you've got the firms providing a product to the households. That's all the circular flow is, and that's what it's showing. 2.5 inflation anticipated versus unanticipated. So when we have anticipated inflation, we can kind of make things happen. We can plan for it. We understand that it's going to happen. And typically we kind of adjust for 2.0. I don't know why I said it that way. 2% inflation. Alrighty. The problem happens is when we see unanticipated. So, no one expected inflation to get as high as 9% like it did last springish or so. I can't remember when it was, but that really hurt people. Because, if you're on a fixed income, meaning you don't have any extra income and you're used to paying, $500 for your groceries and now all of a sudden you're having to pay $700 for your groceries, you're kind of in trouble. Be sure you take a look at the borrowers versus the creditors. Your borrowers are going to benefit here because they got a loan, hopefully a fixed loan, where they're getting to pay money back in money that's not worth as much. Let's do an example real quick. So let's say you're most of you are fixing to go off to college. Let's say that you lock in a four-year lease into the apartment of your dreams, and you are paying, let's say, $1,000 a month. Alrighty. Unanticipated inflation happens. And now all of a sudden that same apartment is worth $2,000, but you're locked in for 4 years for $1,000. You're winning. You are going to benefit from that because you're locked into that $1,000 versus everybody else is moving in that's $2,000. The loser really truly is the landlord because they can't change your contract. And they're having to continue to charge you $1,000, even though other apartments are going for $2,000. Okay. And then we can apply that to anything, any kind of loan, anything like that. 2.3, the unemployment and the formula. So the unemployment rate is the number of unemployed over the labor force times 100. And remember, to be unemployed, you have to be looking for work. Okay. You have to be out of work and looking for work. And you also have to be a part of the labor force, which is 16 and up and actually out there looking for work. 2.1, GDP, what's included? GDP is gross domestic product. Remember that formula, C, which is consumption, plus I, which is investment, plus G, which is government spending, plus the imports minus the exports. Alrighty. And so what's included? Well, that's what's included, is us consuming, businesses investing, and remember, it's not stocks and bonds. It's them going out and opening a new store and things like that, and then the government spending. 2.3, the types of unemployment. So you've got frictional. Remember, this is the type that's going to happen all the time. So in 4 years, y'all are going to graduate from college and you're going to be out there looking for your first job. You're not going to have a job. You're going to be frictionally unemployed. So frictionally unemployed is the reason we can't get to full employment. It's because there's always going to be somebody out there looking for a job that's been not a part of the labor force. You're not a part of the labor force until you actually start looking for a job. Someone that left a job, went home to take care of a family, let's say, now is coming back. They're frictionally unemployed. Structural unemployment. Unemployment caused by changes in the structure of the economy. this is the bad kind for us as workers because this is where our skills are no longer needed. Cyclical unemployment. That's unemployment caused by fluctuations in the business cycle. Remember, you get fired in the recession. You get hired in the upswing. 2.4 and 6, nominal and real GDP. Know the calculation. So nominal GDP measures the total value of goods and services produced in an economy at current market prices without adjusting for inflation. Real GDP measures the total value of goods and services in the economy after adjusting for inflation. And the calculation for real GDP is looking at the GDP inflator or the price index and adjusting nominal GDP in those price levels, which is the next thing, the GDP deflator. It's calculated as the ratio of nominal GDP to real GDP multiplied by 100. All right, so nominal GDP over real GDP times 100 gives you the deflator, and you can use that in figuring out the measure of the price levels for all final goods and services in an economy. 2.4, calculate CPI. So that's the consumer price index. It is what we use to measure inflation. Okay. And it is going to be the cost of basket. Let me take a step. I shouldn't jump right into the formula. So it's going to take a look at a market basket of goods. So it's going to take a look at some common things that people buy. And it's going to take a look at the current year versus a base year. Alrighty. So the formula is the cost of the basket in the current year over the cost of the basket in the base year times 100. And that's going to give you the CPI, and that's going to give you an idea of inflation. So basically, you're comparing what we're spending now to what was being spent in 1985 or 1955 or whatever it might be. 2.1, what counts in GDP? GDP includes the total value of all final goods and services produced within a country's borders during a specific period. And it's going to include consumption, investment spending, government, and then exports. Now, we've already gone over what's in it. Don't forget, it also does not include secondhand sales. So if you are buying a used car, that's not going to count towards GDP. It's also not going to count things that are used in the making of other products. So like a new car, the tires are factored into the GDP of the car. They don't have their own GDP part because that would be double counting. All right. All right, guys. I'm sorry I ran out of time on the Zoom. So if you've been listening to this podcast, I am sorry that I thought I had more time, and then I went too long on some of the topics, so I do apologize. Guys, I wish you the best of luck in all your final exams. I wish you the best. I think most of you are seniors, so I wish you all the luck in the world moving forward in in college or the military, whatever it is you're choosing to do with the next couple of years of your life. But enjoy it. Work hard. And if I can ever help you out, just please let me know. I don't know what I can do, but I can read a paper for you, help you edit it, whatever. If you need it, I'm here. My email doesn't change. Guys, best of luck on everything, and I will see you when I see you. Take care. Bye-bye.